She is a beautiful prostitute, Prabhakar pleaded. So fat she is, and in the most serious and important places. A big handful you can grab anywhere you like. You will be so exciting, you will make yourself sick.
It's a tempting offer, Prabhu, I responded, trying not to laugh. But I'm really not interested. We only left the village yesterday, and I guess my mind is still there. I'm just not in the mood.
Mood is no problem, Baba. Only first you get bumping and jumping, then your bad moods will so quickly change, fat-a-fat.
Maybe you're right, but I think I'll pass all the same.
But she is so experienced, he whined. Those fellows told me she has made sexy business too many times and with too many hundreds of customers in this hotel only. I saw her. I looked on the inside of her eyes and I know that she is a very big expert in the sexy business.
I don't want a prostitute, Prabhu, no matter how expert she is.
But if you only see her, you will be crazy for her.
Sorry, Prabhu.
But I told them that you will come and look at her. Only look. There's no harming for a look, Lin Baba.
No.
But I can't get back my cash deposits if you don't come and do some looking at her.
You paid a cash deposit?
Yes, Lin.
You paid a deposit for me to have sex with a woman in this hotel?
Yes, Lin,
he sighed, raising his arms and letting them fall to his sides in a helpless gesture.
6 months in the village you were. 6 months with no sexy business. I was thinking you must be feeling a big amount of your needs. Now, no cash deposits returned for me if you don't take one very small peeking at her.
Okay, I sighed, copying his helpless gesture. Let's go take a look, just to get you off the hook. I pulled the door of our hotel room shut and locked it. We set off along the wide corridor together. The Apsara Hotel in Aurangabad, north of Bombay, was more than 100 years old and built to serve a different, more splendid age. Its high, wide rooms were graced with open balconies facing the busy street, and they featured fine detail in their cornices and ceiling rosettes. The furniture was shoddy and thrown together in haphazard combinations, however, and the carpet in the corridors had worn through to shaggy holes in many places. The paint was peeling, the walls were bruised with dirt, and the rooms were cheap. Just the place, Prabhakar had assured me, for us to spend a happy night on our way back to Bombay. We stopped outside a door on the far side of our floor of the building. Prabhakar was trembling with excitement. His eyes were alarmingly wide. I knocked. Almost at once, the door opened. A woman, aged something over 50, stood in the doorway. She was wearing a red and yellow sari, and she glared at us malevolently. Behind her in the room were several men. They were dressed in dhotis and white caps, like the farmers in Prabhakar's village, and they sat on the floor to eat a hearty meal of dal, rice, and roti. The woman stepped into the corridor and pulled the door shut behind her. She fixed her gaze on Prabhakar. He was a full head and shoulder shorter than she was, and he returned her baleful stare with the fixity of a school bully's minor henchman.
"You see, Lin," he muttered, never taking his eyes off her. "You see what I told you?"
What I saw was a plain, wide face with a bulbous nose and lips so thin and curled with contempt that her mouth resembled a clam that someone had poked with a stick. The makeup on her face and neck was geisha thick and gave her scowling expression a villainous intensity. Prabhakar spoke to the woman in Marathi.
"Show him."
She responded by lifting aside the covering shawl of her sari to reveal a pudgy roll of stomach. She pinched a good pound or two of the flesh between her stubby fingers and squeezed it, looking at me with one eyebrow raised to invite praise. Prabhakar let out a soft moan and his eyes widened. The woman then scowled dramatically left and right along the corridor before raising her blouse a few centimetres to reveal a long, thin, pendulous breast. She seized the breast and flapped it at me a few times, winking her eyebrow with a bafflingly inscrutable expression. My best guess, stabbing wildly in the dark, was that it might have been a menacing, derisive sneer. Prabhakar's eyes widened even more, and he began to breathe noisily through his open mouth. The woman covered her breast and then whipped her long plait of black hair over her shoulder with a jerk of her head. She took the plait in both hands and began to squeeze downward toward the tapering end with her fingers, as if it was a half-empty tube of toothpaste. A thick dribble of coconut oil gathered before her fingers and dripped from the end of the plait onto the threadbare carpet.
"You know, Lin,"
Prabhakar mumbled, gaping hungrily and almost fearfully at the drips of oil. His right foot actually began to stamp softly on the carpet.
"If you don't want to have a sexy business with this woman, if you really don't want, well, I could use that cash deposit my own good self."
"I'll see you back at the room, Prabhu," I replied, smiling politely at the woman. I offered her a little bow and took her scornful snarl with me back to our room. I thought to use the time to update my Marathi dictionary. There were already some 600 words from everyday usage in the list. I'd made the notes on scraps of paper, as people in the village had given me words and phrases, before transferring them to a sturdy journal for future reference. The last and latest of those notes were spread out on a little writing table, and I'd just begun to enter them in my journal when the door sprang open and Prabhakar swaggered into the room. He walked past me without speaking and fell onto his back on his bed. About 9 minutes had passed since I'd left him at the prostitute's door.
"Oh, Lin,"
he moaned happily, grinning up at the ceiling.
"I knew it. I knew she was a full of experience woman."
I stared at him in bewilderment.
"Oh, yes,"
he gushed, sitting up and letting his short legs swing from the bed.
"She gave me a big money's worth, and I gave it to her a very, very good sex also. And now, let's go out. We will be having some foods and some drinks and a party."
"If you're sure you've got the strength," I muttered.
"Oh, no need for strength in this place, Baba. This place I'm taking you is such a fine place that very often you can even sit down while you are drinking."
As good as his word, Prabhakar directed us to a hovel about an hour's walk past the last bus stop on the outskirts of the town. With a round of drinks for the house, we insinuated ourselves into the crush of dusty, determined drinkers who occupied the bar's one narrow stone bench. The place was what Australians call a sly grog shop, an unlicensed bar where men buy overproof alcohol at under-the-counter prices. The men we joined in the bar were workers, farmers, and a routine assortment of lawbreakers. They all wore sullen, persecuted expressions. They said little or nothing at all. Fierce grimaces disfigured them as they drank the foul-tasting homemade alcohol, and they followed each glass with a miscellany of grunts, groans, and gagging sounds. When we joined them, Prabhakar and I consumed the drinks at a gulp, pinching our noses with one hand and hurling the noxious, chemurgic liquid down our open throats. By means of a fierce determination, we summoned the will to keep the poison in our bellies. And when sufficiently recovered, we launched ourselves, with no little reluctance, into the next venomous round. It was a grim and pleasureless business. The strain showed on every face. Some found the going too hard and slunk away defeated. Some faltered, but were pressed on by the anguished encouragements of fellow sufferers. Prabhakar lingered long over his fifth glass of the volatile fluid. I thought he was about to admit defeat, but at last he gasped and spluttered his way through to empty the glass. Then one man threw his glass aside, stood up, and moved to the centre of the shabby little room. He began to sing in a roaring off-key voice. And because every man of us cheered our passionate and peremptory approval, we all knew that we were drunk. One by one, we sang a song in turn. A weeping rendition of the Indian national anthem was followed by religious devotionals. Hindi love songs jingled beside heartbreaking ghazals. The two burly waiters recognized the new stage of inebriation and abandoned their drinks trays and glasses for a while. They took up their positions, sitting on stools on either side of the entrance door. They smiled broadly, nodded, wagged their heads, and cradled long, thick wooden clubs in the tender embrace of their meaty arms. We all clapped and cheered with every song. When it was my turn, I sang, I don't know why, the old Kinks song, You really got me.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
I was drunk enough to coach Prabhakar, and he was drunk enough to learn the chorus.
Oh, yes, by God, you are a girl, and you really, really got me, isn't it going?
We were still singing on the dark, deserted stretch of road leading back to town. We were still singing when the white ambassador car cruised past us slowly and turned. And we were still singing when the car cruised past us again and then turned one more time to block our path on the shoulder of the road. Four men got out of the car, and one stayed behind the wheel. The tallest of the men grabbed at my shirt and barked a command at me in Marathi.
What is this?
I slurred back at him in Marathi. Another man stepped in from the side and hit me with a short right hand that snapped my head back sharply. Two more quick punches crunched into my mouth and nose. I stumbled back and felt one leg go out from under me. Falling, I saw Prabhakar hurl himself at the four men with his arms wide, trying to hold them back from me. I roused myself and rallied enough to make a charge. My left hook and overhand right elbow, the best hard punches in any street fight, were lucky and both made tough contact. Beside me, Prabhakar went down once, leapt to his feet, and collected a wild haymaker that sent him dazed and sprawling. I tried to stand near him and protect him with my legs, but I tripped and fell clumsily. Kicks and punches rained, and I covered up, hearing a quiet voice in my head that said, "I know this. I know this." The men held me down while one of them went through my pockets with practiced thoroughness. Drunk and damaged, I was only dimly aware of the dark shapes looming over me. Then I heard another voice, Prabhakar's voice, and I understood some of the words in his pleading and his defiant abuse of them. He castigated the men for shaming their own country and their own people by beating and robbing a foreigner, a visitor to their country who'd done them no harm. It was a wild speech that called them cowards and invoked Mahatma Gandhi, Buddha, the god Krishna, Mother Teresa, and the Bollywood film star Amitabh Bachchan in the same sentence. It had an effect. The leader of the group came to squat near me. I tried through my drunken haze to stand and fight again, but the others pushed me down and held me on the ground. "I know this. I know this." The man leaned over to look into my eyes. His face was hard, impassive, and very much like my own. He opened my torn shirt and shoved something inside. It was my passport and my watch. They stood, gave Prabhakar a last scowl of incomprehensible hatred, and then climbed into the car. Doors slammed as the car sped away, scattering us with dust and small stones. Prabhakar's wretchedness, when he was sure that I wasn't badly hurt, and he found time to wail and whine, was inconsolable. He blamed himself, loudly and often, for leading us to the remote bar and for allowing us to drink too much. He said with perfect honesty that he would happily take my bruises on his body if it were possible. His pride in himself as Bombay's best street guide was a tattered banner, and his passionate, unqualified love for his country, Bharat Mataji, Mother India, suffered blows more grievous than any the body might endure.
"There's only one good thing for doing, Lin," he concluded,
as I washed my face at a hand basin in the huge white-tiled bathroom of our hotel.
"When we get back to Bombay, you must be sending a telegram to your family and your friends for more monies, and you must go to your New Zealand embassy for making a complaint of emergencies."
I dried my face and leaned on the basin to look into the mirror. The injuries weren't bad. A black eye was forming. My nose was swollen but not broken. Both lips were cut and thickened, and there were some sweeping grazes on my cheeks and jaw where kicks had scraped away the skin. It could have been a lot worse, and I knew it. I'd grown up in a tough neighborhood where working-class gangs preyed on one another and were merciless to loners, like me, who refused to join any of them. And then there was the prison. No beatings I'd ever suffered were as savage as those inflicted by the uniformed men who were paid to keep the peace, the prison guards. That was what the voice, my own voice, had recalled. "I know this. That was the memory. Being held down by three or four officers in the punishment unit, while two or three others worked me over with fists, batons and boots. It's always worse getting a beating from them, of course, because they're supposed to be the good guys. You understand and accept it when the bad guys work you over. But when the good guys use handcuffs to chain you to a wall, and then take turns to stomp and kick you, it's the whole system, it's the whole world that's breaking your bones. And then there was the screaming. The other men, the other prisoners, screaming. Every night. I looked into my own eyes in the mirror and thought about Prabhakar's suggestion. It was impossible to contact the New Zealand embassy, or any embassy. I couldn't contact family or friends because the police would be watching them and waiting for a connection to be made. There was no one. No help, no money. The thieves had taken every cent I had in the world. The irony of it wasn't lost on me, the escaped armed robber robbed of everything he owned. What was it Carla had said before I'd left for the village? Don't drink any alcohol on the trip. There's no money in New Zealand, Prabhu, I told him as we walked back to our hotel room. There's no family who can help, no friends, and no help at the embassy.
No money?
None.
And you can't get any more? Not from any place?
No, I answered, packing my few belongings into my backpack.
This is a very serious trouble, Lin, if you don't mind I'm telling your bruised and scratchy face.
I know. Do you think we can sell my watch to the hotel manager?
Yes, Lin, I think so, sure. It is a very nice watches. But I don't think so he will give us a big fair price. In such matters, the Indian businessman is putting his religion in his back pocket only, and he is driving very hard bargains on you.
Never mind, I replied, clipping shut the catches on my backpack. So long as it's enough to pay the bill and catch that night train you were talking about back to Bombay. Come on, pack your things and let's go.
It is a very, very, very serious trouble, he said,
as we closed the door to the room for the last time and walked down the corridor.
No money is no funny in India, Lin, I'm telling you.
The frown that compressed his lips and consumed his features remained with us all the way back to Bombay. The sale of my watch covered the hotel bill in Aurangabad, with enough left for 2 or 3 days at the India Guest House in Bombay. With my gear stowed in my favourite room, I walked Prabhakar back to the small entrance foyer of the hotel, trying in vain to revive the little miracle of his wondrous smile.
You will leave all those unhappy things in my caring, he said, earnest and solemn. You will see, Lin. I will make a happy result on you.
I watched him walk down the stairs, and then heard the manager, Anand, address me in friendly Marathi. I turned with a smile, and we began to talk in Marathi. 6 months in the village had given me the simple, everyday conversational phrases, questions, and sentences. It was a modest achievement, but Anand was obviously very pleased and surprised. After a few minutes of conversation, he called all the co-managers and room boys to hear me speak in their language. They all reacted with similarly delighted astonishment. They'd known foreigners who spoke a little Hindi, or even spoke it well, but none of them had ever met a foreigner who could converse with them in their own beloved Marathi language. They asked me about the village of Sunda. They'd never heard of it. And we talked about the daily life that they all knew well from their own villages and tended to idolize in recollection. When the conversation ended, I returned to my room and had barely shut the door when a tentative knock sounded at it.
Excuse me, please. I'm sorry to disturb.
The voice belonged to a tall, thin foreigner, German or Swiss, perhaps, with a wispy beard attached to the point of his long face and fair hair pulled back into a thick plait.
I heard you speaking to the manager and the room boys before, and, well, it is sure that you have been here in India very long. And, Maya, we just arrived today, my girlfriend and me, and we want to buy some hashish. Do you maybe know where we can get for ourselves some hashish without somebody cheating us and without trouble from the police?
I did know, of course. Before the night was out, I also helped them to change money on the black market without being cheated. The bearded German and his girlfriend were happy with the deal, and they paid me a commission. The black marketeers, who were Prabhakar's friends and contacts on the street, were happy that I'd brought new customers to them, and they paid me commissions as well. I knew there would be other foreigners on every street in Colaba who wanted to score. That casual conversation in Marathi with Anand and the room boys of the hotel, overheard by the German couple, had given me a way to survive in the city. A more pressing problem, however, was my tourist visa. When Anand had signed me into the hotel, he'd warned me that my visa had expired. Every hotel in Bombay had to supply a register of foreign guests with a valid visa entry for each foreign name and passport number. The register was known as the C form, and the police were vigilant in its supervision. Overstaying on a visa was a serious offence in India. Prison terms of up to 2 years were sometimes imposed, and the police levied heavy fines on hotel operators who permitted C-form irregularities. Anand had explained all that to me, gravely, before he fudged the figures in his register and signed me in. He liked me. He was Maharashtrian, and I was the first foreigner he'd ever met who spoke the Marathi language with him. He was happy to break the rules for me, once, but he warned me to visit the foreigner registration branch at police headquarters immediately to see about an extension on my visa. I sat in my room and weighed the options. There weren't many. I had very little money. True, I'd inadvertently discovered a way to earn money as a middleman, a go-between, helping wary foreigners to deal with black marketeers. However, I wasn't sure if it would provide me with enough money to live in hotels and eat in restaurants. It certainly wouldn't pay for a plane ticket out of India. Moreover, I was already an overstayer on my visa, and technically guilty of a criminal offence. Anand assured me that the cops would see the lapsed visa as a mere oversight, and extend it without inquiry. But I couldn't risk my freedom on that chance. I couldn't visit the foreigner registration branch. So I couldn't alter my visa status, and I couldn't stay at a hotel in Bombay without a valid visa. I was caught between the rock of regulations and the hard place of the fugitive life. I lay back on the bed, in the dark, listening to the sounds of the street that rose to my open window. The panwala, calling customers to the delights of his aromatic morsels. The watermelon man, piercing the warm, humid night with his plangent cry. A street acrobat shouting through his sweaty exertions for a crowd of tourists. And music, always music. Did ever a people love music, I wondered, more than the Indians? Thoughts of the village, thoughts I'd avoided and resisted until that music began, danced into my mind. On the day that Prabhakar and I had left the village, the people had invited me to live with them. They'd offered me a house and a job. In the last 3 months of my stay, I'd been helping the teacher at the local school with special lessons in spoken English. I gave him clear pronunciations of English words, helping him to correct the heavily accented versions of the language that he'd been teaching to the children. The teacher and the village council had urged me to stay. There was a place for me, a place and a purpose. But it wasn't possible for me to return to Sunda village. Not then. A man can make his way in the city with his heart and his soul crushed within a clenched fist, but to live in a village, he has to unfurl his heart and his soul in his eyes. I carried crime and punishment with me in every hour of my life. The same fate that helped me to escape from prison had clamped its claws on my future. Sooner or later, if they looked hard enough and long enough, the people would see those claws in my eyes. Sooner or later there would be a reckoning. I'd passed myself off as a free man, a peaceful man, and for a little while I'd known real happiness in the village. But my soul wasn't clean. What would I do to prevent my recapture? What wouldn't I do? Would I kill to save myself from prison? I knew the answers to those questions, and I knew that my presence in Sunda defiled the village. I knew that every smile I took from them was swindled. Life on the Run puts a lie in the echo of every laugh, and at least a little larceny in every act of love. There was a knock at the door. I called out that it was open. Anand stepped into my room and announced with distaste that Prabhakar had come to see me, with two of his friends. I clapped Anand on the back, smiling at his concern for me, and we walked to the hotel foyer.
"Oh, Lynn," Prabhakar beamed when our eyes met. "I have the very good news for you. This is my friend, Johnny Cigar. He is a very important friend in the Jopad party, the slum where we live. And this is Raju. He helps Mr. Kasim Ali Hussein, who is the head man in the slum."
I shook hands with the two men. Johnny Cigar was almost exactly my height and build, which made him taller and heavier than the Indian average. I judged him to be about 30 years old. His long face was candid and alert. The sand-coloured eyes fixed me with a steady, confident gaze. His thin moustache was trimmed to a precise line over an expressive mouth and determined jaw. The other man, Raju, was only a little taller than Prabhakar and of an even slighter build. His gentle face was stamped with a sadness that invited sympathy. It was the kind of sadness that's a companion all too often to scrupulous and uncompromising honesty. Thick brows hooded his intelligent dark eyes. They stared at me, those knowing, mindful eyes, from a tired, sagging face that seemed much older than the 35 years I guessed him to be. I liked both men on sight. We talked for a while, the new men asking me questions about Prabhakar's village and my impressions of life there. They asked me about the city as well, wanting to know my favourite places in Bombay and the things I like to do most. When the conversation seemed likely to continue, I invited them to join me at one of the nearby restaurants for chai.
"No, no, Lynn," Prabhakar declined, waggling his head. "We must be leaving now. Only I wanted you to meet the Johnny and the Raju, and them to be meeting your good self also. I think that Johnny Cigar has some things to tell you now, isn't it?"
He looked at Johnny, his eyes and his mouth wide open, and his hands raised in expectation. Johnny glowered at him, but the frown quickly softened into a broad smile, and he turned his attention to me.
"We made a decision for you," Johnny Cigar declared. "You will live with us. You are Prabhakar's good friend. There's a place for you."
"Yes, Lynn," Prabhakar added quickly. "One family is leaving tomorrow, and then, the day after tomorrow, that house will be yours."
But, I stammered, flattered by the generous gesture, and yet horrified at the thought of life in the slum. I remembered my one visit to Prabhakar's slum only too well. The smell of the open latrines, the heartbreaking poverty, the cramp and mill of people, thousands upon thousands of people. It was a kind of hell in my memory, a new metaphor that stood for the worst, or almost the worst, that could happen.
"No problem, Lynn," Prabhakar laughed. "You will be too happy with us, you will see. And you know, you're looking like a different fellow now, it is true. But after a few months with us, you will look exactly the same as everyone else there. People will think you are already living in the slum for years and years and years. You will see."
"It is a place for you," Raju said, reaching out slowly to touch my arm. "A safe place, until you can save your money. Our hotel is free."
The others laughed at that, and I joined them, inspired by their optimism and enthusiasm. The slum was filthy and crowded beyond imagining, but it was free, and there were no C forms for the residents. It would give me time to think, I knew, and time to plan.
Thanks, Prabhu. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Raju. I accept your offer. I'm very grateful. Thank you."
"No problem," Johnny Cigar replied, shaking my hand and meeting my eye with a determined, penetrating stare.
I didn't know then that Johnny and Raju had been sent by the head man of the slum, Kasim Ali Hussein, to look me over. In my ignorance and self-centeredness, I'd recoiled at the thought of the terrible conditions of the slum and accepted their offer reluctantly. I didn't know that the huts were in much demand, and that there was a long list of families waiting for a place. I couldn't know then that offering a place to me meant that a family in need had missed out on a home. As the last step in making that decision, Kasim Ali Hussein had sent Raju and Johnny to my hotel. Raju's task was to determine whether I could live with them. Johnny's task was to make sure that they could live with me. All I knew on that first night of our meeting was that Johnny's handshake was honest enough to build a friendship on, and Raju's sad smile had more acceptance and trust in it than I deserved.
Okay, Lin, Prabhakar grinned. Day after tomorrow, we come to pick up your many things, and your good self also, in the late of afternoon.
Thanks, Prabhu. Okay, but wait, day after tomorrow, won't that mess up our appointment?
Appointment? What for an appointment, Lin Baba?
The standing babas, I replied lamely. The standing babas, a legendary cloister of mad, inspired monks, ran a hashish den in suburban Baikula. Prabhakar had taken me there as part of his dark tour of the city months before. On the way back to Bombay from the village, I'd made him promise to take me there again, with Kala. I knew she'd never been to the den, and I knew she was fascinated by the stories she'd heard of it. Raising the matter then, in the face of their hospitable offer, was ungrateful, but I didn't want to miss the chance to impress her with the visit.
Oh, yes, Lin, no problem. We can still make a visit to those standing babas with the Miss Kala, and after that we will collect up all your things. I will see you here day after tomorrow at 3 o'clock afternoon. I am so happy you are going to be a slum-living fellow with us, Lin. So happy.
He walked out of the foyer and descended the stairwell. I watched him join the lights and traffic stirring on the noisy street, 3 floors below. Worries waned and receded. I had a way to make a little money. I had a safe place to stay. And then, as if that safety allowed them to, my thoughts wound and spiraled along the streets and alleys to Kala. I found myself thinking of her apartment, of her ground floor windows, those tall French doors that looked out on the cobbled lane, not 5 minutes away from my hotel. But the doors I pictured in my mind stayed shut. And as I tried and failed to form an image of her face, her eyes, I suddenly realized that if I became a slum dweller, if I lived in those squalid, squirming acres, I might lose her. I probably would lose her. I knew that if I fell that far, as I saw it then, my shame would keep me from her as completely and mercilessly as a prison wall. In my room, I lay down to sleep. The move to the slum would give me time. It was a hard solution to the visa problem, but a practical one. I felt relieved and optimistic about it, and I was very tired. I should have slept well. But my dreams that night were violent and troubled. Didier once told me, in a rambling midnight dissertation, that a dream is the place where a wish and a fear meet. When the wish and the fear are exactly the same, he said, we call the dream a nightmare. Chapter 8. The standing babas were men who'd taken a vow never to sit down or lie down ever again for the rest of their lives. They stood, day and night, forever. They ate their meals standing up and made their toilet standing up. They prayed and worked and sang standing up. They even slept while they were standing, suspended in harnesses that kept the weight of their bodies on their legs, but prevented them from falling when they were unconscious. For the first 5 to 10 years of that constant standing, their legs began to swell. Blood moved sluggishly in exhausted veins, and muscles thickened. Their legs became huge, bloated out of recognizable shape, and covered with purple varicose boils. Their toes squeezed out from thick, fleshy feet like the toes of elephants. During the following years, their legs gradually became thinner and thinner. Eventually, only bones remained, with a paint-thin veneer of skin and the termite trails of withered veins. The pain was unending and terrible. Spikes and spears of agony stabbed up through their feet with every downward pressure. Tormented, tortured, the standing Bubbas were never still. They shifted constantly from foot to foot in a gentle swaying dance that was as mesmerizing for everyone who saw it as the sound-weaving hands of a flute player for his cobras. Some of the Bubbas had made the vow when they were 16 or 17 years old. They were compelled by something like the vocation that calls others, in other cultures, to become priests, rabbis, or imams. A larger number of much older men had renounced the world as a preparation for death and the next level of incarnation. Not a few of the standing Bubbas were businessmen who'd given themselves to ruthless pursuits of pleasure, power, and profit during their working lives. They were holy men who'd journeyed through many other devotions, mastering their punishing sacrifices before undertaking the ultimate vow of the standing Bubba. And there were criminals, thieves, murderers, major mafia figures, and even former warlords, who sought expiation or propitiation in the endless agonies of the vow. The den was really a corridor between two brick buildings at the rear of their temple. Hidden from view forever, within the temple compound, were the secret gardens, cloisters, and dormitories that only those who made and kept the vow ever saw. An iron roof covered the den. The floor was paved with flat stones. The standing Bubbas entered through a door at the rear of the corridor. Everyone else entered and left through an iron gate at the street end. The customers, men from every part of the country and every level of society, stood along the walls of the corridor. They stood, of course. No one ever sat in the presence of the standing Bubbas. There was a tap fixed over an open drain near the entrance gate, where men drank water or leaned over to spit. The Bubbas moved from man to man and group to group, preparing hashish in funnel-shaped clay chillums for the customers and smoking with them. The faces of the Bubbas were radiant with their excruciation. Sooner or later, in the torment of endlessly ascending pain, every man of them assumed a luminous, transcendent beatitude. Light, made from the agonies they suffered, streamed from their eyes. And I've never known a human source more brilliant than their tortured smiles. The Bubbas were also comprehensively, celestially, and magnificently stoned. They smoked nothing but Kashmiri, the best hashish in the world, grown and produced at the foothills of the Himalayas in Kashmir. And they smoked it all day and all night, all their lives. I stood with Kala and Prabhaka at the back wall of the narrow den. Behind us was the sealed door through which the standing Bubbas had entered. In front of us were two lines of men, standing along the walls all the way to the iron gate at the street end of the passage. Some of the men were dressed in suits, some wore designer jeans. Workmen wearing faded lungis stood beside men in traditional dress from various regions of India. They were young and old, rich and poor. Their eyes were often drawn to Kala and me, pale-skinned foreigners, standing with our backs against the wall. It was clear that some of them were shocked to see a woman in the den. Despite their open curiosity, no one approached us or acknowledged us directly, and for the most part they gave their attention to the standing Bubbas and the hashish. Conversations, buzzing softly, blended with music and devotional chanting, coming from somewhere inside the compound. "So, what do you think?"
"It's incredible," she replied,
her eyes gleaming in the soft light of the shaded lamps. She was exhilarated and perhaps a little unnerved. Smoking the charas had relaxed the muscles of her face and shoulders, but there were tigers moving quickly in the eyes of her soft smile.
"It's amazing. It's horrible and holy at the same time. I can't make up my mind which is the holy part and which is the horrible part. Horrible, that's not the right word, but it's something like that."
"I know what you mean," I agreed, thrilled that I'd succeeded in impressing her. She'd been in the city for 5 years, and she'd heard about the Bubbas many times, but that visit with me was her first. My tone implied that I knew the place well, but I couldn't fairly claim credit for the experience. Without Prabhaka, who'd knocked on the gate for us and gained access with his golden smile, we wouldn't have been permitted to enter. One of the standing Babas approached us slowly with an acolyte who held a silver tray containing chillums, charas, and the paraphernalia of smoking. Other monks rocked and swayed along the length of the corridor, smoking and chanting prayers. The Baba standing before us was tall and lean, but his legs were so thickly swollen that dreadful ropes of distended veins throbbed on their surfaces. His face was thin. The bones of his skull near the temples were sharply defined. His cheekbones, majestic, presided over deep valleys that ran to a hard and hungry jaw. His eyes were huge, within the caverns ridged by his brows, and there was such madness and longing and love in them that he was at once fearsome and immensely pitiable. He prepared the chillum, rocking from side to side and smiling absently. He never looked at us, but still it seemed to be the smile of a very close friend, indulgent, knowing, forgiving. He was standing and swaying so close to me that I could see each wiry strand in the forest of his brows. I heard the little gasps of his breathing. The rapid outward rushes of air sounded like wavelets on a steep shore. He finished preparing the chillum and looked up at me. For a moment I was lost in the vision that swarmed and screeched in his eyes. For a tiny moment, in the infinitude of his suffering, I almost felt it. What the human will can drive the human body to endure and achieve. I almost understood it, that smile of his, driven insane by the will that forced it to shine. I was sure that he was communicating it to me, that he wanted me to know. And I tried to tell him, with my eyes alone, that I could almost sense it, almost feel it. Then he held the chillum to his mouth, in the funnel of his hand, puffed it alight, and offered it to me. That terrible intimacy with his unending pain shriveled, the vision shimmered, and the moment drifted away with the fading white shadows of the smoke. He turned and tottered slowly back towards the street gate, muttering prayers in a soft drone. A scream pierced the air. Everyone turned to the street entrance gate. A man, dressed in the red turban, vest and silk trousers of a northern tribesman, stood there, near the iron gate, shrieking at the very top of a strong voice. Before we could discern his message or react in any way, the man drew a long, thick-bladed sword from his belted sash and raised it over his head. Still screaming, he began to stalk along the corridor. He was staring directly at me as he walked, with a stomping, marching tread. I couldn't understand the words he was screeching, but I knew what he had in mind. He wanted to attack me. He wanted to kill me. The men standing at the sides flattened their backs against the walls instinctively. The standing Babas rocked themselves out of the madman's path. The door behind us was locked shut. There was no escape. We were unarmed. The man walked on towards us, waving the sword in circles over his head with both hands. There was nowhere to go, and nothing to do but to fight him. I took one step back with the right foot and raised my fists. It was a karate stance. 7 years of martial arts training pulsed and flickered in my arms and legs. I felt good about it. Like every other tough, angry man I knew, I avoided fighting until it came to me, and then I enjoyed it. At the last possible moment, a man stepped out from the wall at the side, tripped the goose-stepping tribesman, and sent him crashing to the stone floor. The sword fell from his hand and clattered to a stop at Carla's feet. I snatched it up and watched as the man who tripped our assailant held him in a firm but merciful submission hold. He gripped the fallen man's arm in a hammerlock behind his back. At the same time, he twisted the collar of the man's shirt to choke off a little air. The anger or madness that had possessed the swordsman subsided, and he surrendered passively. Men who knew him stepped forward and escorted him out to the alley beyond the iron gate. Seconds later, one of the men returned and approached me. Looking into my eyes, he held out his hands, palms upward, for the sword. I hesitated, but then handed it over. The man gave us a polite and apologetic bow and left the den. In the bubble and chatter that followed his departure, I checked on Carla. Her eyes were wide, and she pursed her lips in a wondering smile, but she wasn't distressed. Reassured, I went to thank the man who'd stepped in to help us. He was tall, taller than I am by a few centimetres, and had a strong athletic build. His thick black hair was unusually long for Bombay in those years, and he wore it in a high ponytail. His silk shirt and loose trousers were black, and he wore black leather sandals.
"Abdullah,"
he replied, when I told him my name.
"Abdullah Taheri."
"I owe you one, Abdullah," I said, giving him a smile that was as cautious as it was grateful. He'd moved with such lethal grace that he made the trick of disarming the swordsman seem effortless. But it wasn't as easy as it looked. I knew how much skill and courage it had taken, and how big a role instinct had played in his timing. The man was a natural, a born fighter. "That was damn close."
"No problem," he smiled. "He was drunk, I think, that fellow, or not right in his head."
"Whatever his problem was, I still owe you one," I insisted.
"No, really,"
he laughed. It was an easy laugh, revealing white teeth. The sound of it came from deep within his chest, a laugh from the heart. His eyes were the colour of sand in the palm of your hand, a few minutes before the sun sinks below the sea. "All the same, I want to thank you."
"Okay,"
he conceded, clapping a hand to my shoulder. I returned to Carla and Prabhakar. When we turned to leave the den, Abdullah was already gone. The alley outside was deserted, and within a few minutes we caught a taxi back to Colaba. Carla was silent during the ride, and I too said nothing, miserable that my attempt to impress her had ended in such confusion and near disaster. Only Prabhakar felt free to speak.
"What a lucky escapes,"
he said, from the front seat, grinning at us in turn as we sat together but apart in the back of the taxi.
"I thought a sure thing that fellow would chop us up in teeny pieces. Some of the people should not be smoking the charas, isn't it? Some of the people get very angry when they relax their brains."
At Leopold's, I got out of the taxi and stood with Carla while Prabhakar waited. A late afternoon crowd surged around the island of our silent stare.
"You're not coming in?"
"No," I answered, wishing that the moment was more like the strong, confident scene I'd imagined through most of that day. "I'm going to collect my stuff from the India guest house and move to the slum. In fact, I won't be coming to Leopold's for a while, or anywhere else for that matter. I'm going to, you know, get on my feet, or, I don't know, find my feet, or, I'm going to, what was I saying?"
"Something about your feet."
"Yeah," I laughed. "Well, you got to start somewhere."
"This is kind of goodbye, isn't it?"
"Not really," I muttered. "Well, yes, yes, it is."
"And you only just got back from the village."
"Yeah," I laughed again. "From the village to the slum. It's quite a jump."
"Just make sure you land on your
feet." "Okay, I got it."
"Listen, if it's a question of money, I could..."
"No," I said quickly. "No, I want to do this. It's not just money. I..." For 3 seconds, I balanced on the edge of telling her about my visa problems. Her friend, Letty, knew someone at the foreigner registration branch. She'd helped Maurizio, I knew, and there was a chance that she could help me. But then I drew back from the edge and covered the truth with a smile. Telling Carla about the visa would lead to other questions that I couldn't answer. I was in love with her, but I wasn't sure that I could trust her. It's a fact of life on the run that you often love more people than you trust. For people in the safe world, of course, exactly the opposite is true. "I think this will be quite an adventure. I'm actually looking forward to it."
"Okay," she said, nodding her head slowly in acceptance. "Okay, but you know where I live. Come by and see me when you get the chance."
"Sure," I answered. And we both smiled, and we both knew that I wouldn't visit her.
Sure. And you know where I am, with Prabhakar. You do the same.
She reached out to take my hand in hers, and then leaned over to kiss me on the cheek. She turned to leave, but I held her hand.
Don't you have any advice for me?
I asked, trying to find another laugh.
No, she said impassively. I'd only give you advice if I didn't care what happens to you.
It was something. It wasn't much, but it was something to hold on to and shape my love around and keep me wishing. She walked away. I watched her step into the brittle brightness and banter of Leopold's, and I knew that a door to her world had closed for a time. For as long as I lived in the slum, I would be exiled from that little kingdom of light. Living in the slum would consume me and conceal me as effectively as if the mad swordsman had struck me with his blade. I slammed the door of the taxi and looked at Prabhakar, whose wide and beaming smile across the seat in front of me became the world.
Tik hai, chalo, I said. Okay, let's go.
We pulled up, 40 minutes later, outside the slum in Cuff Parade, beside the World Trade Center. The contrast between the adjacent and roughly equal plots of land was stark. To the right, looking from the road, the World Trade Center was a huge, modern, air-conditioned building. It was filled to 3 levels with shops and displays of jewels, silks, carpets, and intricate craftworks. To the left was the slum, a sprawling 10 acres of wretched poverty, with 7,000 tiny huts, housing 25,000 of the city's poorest people. To the right, there were neon lights and floodlit fountains. To the left, there was no electricity, no running water, no toilets, and no certainty that the whole shamble and bustle of it wouldn't be swept away from one day to the next by the same authorities that reluctantly tolerated it. I turned my eyes from the glamorous limousines, drawn up outside the trade centre, and began the long walk into the slum. There was an open latrine near the entrance, concealed by tall weeds, and screens made from reed mats. The smell was appalling and almost overpowering. It was like a physical element permeating the air, and it seemed that I could feel it settle on my skin in a thickening, slimy ooze. Gagging and swallowing back the impulse to vomit, I glanced at Prabhakar. His smile had dimmed, and for the first time I saw something like cynicism in it.
"See, Lin," he said, with that uncharacteristically hard little smile drawing down the corners of his mouth. "See how the people live."
Once past the latrines, and within the first lane of huts, however, there were fitful gusts of wind from a wide arc of seacoast that formed the furthermost edge of the slum. The air was hot and steamy, but the breeze dispersed the noisome stink from the latrine. Smells of spices, cooking, and incense predominated. Seen up close, the huts were pitiful structures made from scraps of plastic and cardboard, thin bamboo poles, and flat reed mats for walls. They were erected over bare earth. Patches of concrete and stonework showed in some places, where the old floors and foundations of the original buildings, cleared from the site years before, remained intact. As I walked along the narrow, rag and plastic lanes of the slum, word spread that the foreigner was on his way. A large crowd of children gathered and pooled around Prabhakar and me, close to us but never touching. Their eyes were wide with surprise and excitement. They burst into fierce gusts of nervous laughter, shouted to one another, and leapt into jerky, spontaneous dances as we approached. People came out of their huts to stand in every doorway. Dozens, and eventually hundreds of people, crowded into the side lanes and the occasional gaps between the houses. They were all staring at me with such gravity, such a fixity of frowning intensity, that I felt sure they must bear me enormous ill will. I was wrong, of course. I couldn't know then, on my first day, that the people were simply staring at my fear.
They were trying to understand what demons haunted my mind, causing me to dread so terribly the place they knew to be a sanctuary from fates far worse than slum life. And the fact was that for all my fear of its swarm and squalor, I did know a fate far worse than slum life. It was a fate so bad that I'd climbed a prison wall and given up everything that I knew, everything I was, everything I loved, to escape it.
"This is now your house, Lin,"
Prabhaka proudly announced over the giggling and chatter of the children when we reached the hut.
"Go inside. See all for yourself."
The hut was identical to the others around it. The roof was a sheet of black plastic. The frame was made from thin bamboo poles bound together with coconut fibre twine. The walls were made from hand-woven reed matting. The floor was bare earth, pressed flat and smooth by the feet of the hut's previous tenants. The door was a thin piece of plywood, dangling on rope hinges. The plastic ceiling was so low that I had to stoop, and the whole room was about 4 paces long by 2 paces wide. It was almost exactly the same size as a prison cell. I put my guitar in one corner, and then dragged the first aid kit from the pack, setting it up in another corner. I had a couple of wire coat hangers, and I was hanging my few clothes in the upper corners of the hut when Prabhaka called me from outside. I stepped out to find Johnny Cigar, Raju, Prabhaka, and several other men standing together in the lane. I greeted those I knew and was introduced to the others.
"This is Anand, your neighbour on the one side, on left side,"
Prabhaka said, bringing me to shake hands with a tall, handsome young Sikh who wore his long hair in a tight yellow scarf. "Hello," I said, smiling in response to the warmth of his strong handshake. "I know another Anand, the manager of the India Guest House."
"Is he a good man?"
Anand asked, through a puzzled frown.
"He's a nice guy. I like him."
"Good,"
Anand replied, giving me a boyish smile that undermined the serious tone in his deep voice.
"Then we are halfway to being friends, no?"
"Anand, he shares his house with another of bachelors with name Rafiq," Prabhaka continued.
Rafiq was about 30 years old. A straggly beard dangled from his pointed chin. His very prominent front teeth gaped from an impoverished grin. His eyes narrowed unfortunately in the expression and gave him a sly, almost malevolent appearance.
"On the other side is our very good neighbour, Jitendra. His wife has the name Radha."
Jitendra was short and plump. He smiled happily and shook my hand, rubbing vigorously at his prominent paunch all the while. His wife, Radha, acknowledged my smile and nod of greeting by drawing her red cotton shawl over her head and holding it across her face with her teeth.
"Do you know?"
Anand said in a gentle conversational tone that caught me by surprise.
"It is a fire, I believe."
He was standing on his stretched toes and shading his eyes from the afternoon sun with his hand as he looked away across the black dunes of the huts. Everyone followed his gaze. There was a humid, ominous silence. Then, several hundred meters away, a gorgeous plume of orange flames erupted skyward. An explosion followed, sounding like a shotgun blast into a metal shed. Every man ran at top pace in the direction of the yellow spears of flame that rose in the distance. I stood still, fascinated, bewildered, staring at the flames and spirals of smoke. As I watched, the jets of fire expanded to become a sheet and then a wall of searing flames. The red, yellow, and orange wall began to advance with the breeze from the sea, engulfing new huts every few seconds. It was heading directly toward me, at slow walking pace, incinerating everything that stood in its path. Explosions thundered in the blaze. One, two, another. I realized at last that they were kerosene stoves. Every one of the 7,000 huts had a stove. Those that were pumped up and under pressure were exploding when the flames reached them. The last monsoon rain had fallen weeks before. The slum was a huge pile of tinder-dry kindling, and a strengthening sea breeze fanned the flames through a whole acre of fuel and human lives. Stunned, afraid, but not in panic, I watched the inexorable advance of the